Well, I think I'd like to start the next session, which is our keynote panel and keynote address. You will see that right in front of you, there are actually three people sitting here, and we're actually not starting with Mark Ott. We're starting by introducing another one of our Atkin Fellows, and if you stay the whole day, you will have met them all, because they all have important roles in introducing speakers or chairing some of the sessions. The Atkin Fellow that I would like to introduce to you right now is Odeh Abu Quresh from Palestine, who was with us here at King's at ICSR until last month, and he's going to introduce Mark Ott to you. Odeh.
Actually, it's my great honor to have this opportunity to introduce Mr. Mark Ott, who is the European Union Special Representative for the Middle East peace process, and the well-known diplomat who held many positions during his life, including being ambassador to Israel from 1992 till 1996. But I'll take this opportunity to raise my disagreement with Mr. Pfluger, the previous speaker, about the European Union role in the peace process and conflict resolution, where I suppose that we are here because of the European effort, not because of the American effort. We're here, Palestinian Israelis and internationals, because of Oslo Accords, which is sponsored by the European nations, which the Americans failed to get during Washington negotiation. And I would like to hear more about the European approach from Mr. Mark Ott. Welcome, Mr. Mark.
Thank you very much. And thank you to the organizers for inviting me. And I look forward to having an exchange with you. I would try to limit my remarks and time to have rather a conversation. First of all, thank you, Odeh, for this introduction. If I may say, you represent one of the best reasons why we should be interested in making peace in this region, or helping to make peace in this region. Because your generation has grown and has known only the conflict and deserve a better situation. What I think what I see with you and some others and across the Green Line with Israeli youth is how much potential there is there and how much we have to rely on the younger generation to do away with the prejudice that has been plaguing the conflict in the region. I make the same experience in other Arab countries. I've seen the same things in Turkey, and I think our best hope is the next generation. I really believe that, and that is not limited to men. It's also the better half. Women are also playing, I think, a very positive and very constructive role. Even in countries where you would think women have a lesser role, I've seen a lot of Saudi women that are social actors, very active, are business people, are will, I guess, soon enter politics somehow. So that is, if there was an inspiration for this debate, is about that. I think we need to, therefore, also commend you for this initiative of attracting young people here. The second remark I'd like to make is that if you hope to know after I talk all what the Europeans do, well, I'm sorry, but I think I will disappoint you, because I know a little bit of what the Europeans do and think, but as you know, Europe, at least the member states of the EU, have decided to have a common foreign policy, but not a single foreign policy. So there's a lot of other areas, maybe shady areas, where you might see European actions contradict other European actions. I still do my best to create a consensus, I think as far as the Middle East is concerned, and as far as maybe other areas, the Europeans have not fared too badly as the EU to present a common front based on common values and ambitions. Now, often when I go to a panel like this to talk about the Middle East peace process, the Middle East conflict, the European role, etc., there are two things that make it difficult. First of all, I meet a lot of people that are much more experienced than me in the audience. Secondly, the dilemma is to say, what else can you say that has not been said yet? And it's a bit the sort of reflection that one has when you are at the start of a new hope or a new window of opportunities, like politicians say, is to say, why now and not before, or why now and not later? And it's a question that is asked often by even people in the region. It says, why do you think you're going to succeed now? So what does it mean? Have we missed huge opportunities? I often think at the end of the Cold War, like a unique opportunity because of the end of the East-West confrontation could have been seized, where Israel, for instance, was in a very favorable position vis-à-vis its Arab neighbors. Have these opportunities been missed? And the second question is, can we learn something from the past? Can we, or are we condemned to walk a graveyard of failed opportunities, of failed attempts, of peace plans that have either fizzled out or fired back on their authors? And I have often the impression that leaders of the region are trying to repeat the thing that they have not succeeded before. It's really something that makes me think that although the old conflicts, the core issues, as they are called, are the same, in the meantime, we seem to be missing that there's a big change in the strategic context in the region. And on top of that, and the region is affected by that, there is a new world disorder that has been happening in front of our eyes and has created havoc in the economies, in the livelihoods of people, and certainly it is felt also in the region. And this new strategic context, we should have it. What do I mean by that? Well, first of all, there are new players. Certainly, 10 years ago, Iran was not the sort of elephant in the room that it is today. There are new players also that were not there as strategic threats. They were annoyances or low-level threats, as we say. Hamas, Hezbollah have become strategic threats. They can actually put a powerful country like Israel in a very difficult strategic position. And they are working hand in hand with some of these countries who want to exist by being spoilers. So I think this is something new, and this is something that is another reason why we should pay attention. If something goes wrong with Iran, I'm not sure Israel will be the first target. And remember, the Iranian missiles can reach Rome or Greece. This is also something that is quite new and raised the stakes. There is the issue of governance that has become more prevalent now. The deficit in governance are showing the failure of Arab countries, Arab regimes, and other countries, and now Iran, to meet the expectations of their own people. This failure of governance is mirrored by the failure of governance at the global level. We have not found the right way to tackle global warming, to tackle energy issues, energy supplies, and in a way that also plays a part in the calculations in the region. And a consequence of this lack of this breakdown in governance is the radicalization of societies. Life is everywhere. A Moroccan minister who I was at a dinner recently, and I asked him, what do your people think about Palestine? Your young people, young generation. And his reply was to say, they all want to take a plane and go fight in Gaza with the Palestinians. So this is something that not only a repercussion in the region itself, which makes it difficult to create the space for peaceful solution, it has repercussions in our own countries. Remember the demonstration during the Gaza operation last time. I remember, I was in Brussels at the time. What struck me is that the flags that were flying there were Hezbollah flags. The representative of the PLO in Brussels told me she had to leave the demonstrations because people were crying death to Mubarak. So I think this aspect of radicalization is one of the reasons of the urgency to change the status quo. The same is true for the interconnection of issues and the strategic preoccupations of the players in the region, at least, are now going from Morocco to Afghanistan. So the image of the region has stretched from being, you know, something confined to the eastern shore of the Mediterranean to something that affects all the societies there and goes beyond, of course, Arab countries. And in view of that, I think there is a perception of failure of the West. Very strong. Not always people rejoicing about that, but a perception of failure. And that the tools that we have applied for peacemaking, for reconstruction, for better governance seem to be failing, or that we don't find the resources for it. But it is clear in many places, to me, as a European, it is one of the central questions, because we have always said or thought that projecting our model would be welcome automatically and automatically produce positive results. I think this is something that in Afghanistan is particularly crucial now. If we fail, if the West, if NATO and the EU fail in Afghanistan, it will be the beginning of an unraveling of Western position. And when we are talking about reordering the world, I invite you to read the interview of President Lula of Brazil this morning in Le Monde, in the newspaper. He said the G8 is no longer legitimate. You guys cannot decide the fate of the world. We are important. And therefore, when you see the emergence of what is called the BRIC, for instance, the famous acronym for the Brazil, Russia, India, China, well, we in the West must think that we must not think that the world will be reorganized according to our values, and that these countries will automatically say, oh, of course, we've now seen the light, the West, we aspire to be part of it. No, it's not at all the case. The most important summit at the summit of the G20 was the G2 between the US and China, and it's obvious that this is a new type of relations and a new type of organization that, for Europe in particular, which becomes more and more an area of prosperity at the far end of a small continent, of a huge continent, particularly important if we want to stay in the future. Now, when you're going back to the region and the Middle East, I think especially in view of this transformation that is happening without us even realizing how big this transformation is that history books and holy books are telling a lot of things about the past, but they offer very little in terms of recipe for the future. And I think this guidance about what sort of world we want needs to be found, needs to be invented. We need a new script for the future. So I think one needs... There is a need for change, a change in the vocabulary, a change in the mindset, a change about the instruments, a change of the method to become an actor in the 21st century, not in the 20th century. And if that idea of change sounds familiar, I'm sure you've heard it before, or you've heard it recently, I think it's that. And I think that's the new wind blowing from Washington that is extremely important for us, because we are part of this world, and we are the nearest allies of America. The question is, of course, now, will it really bring change, or will it be nice words? The jury is still out, although some things have been taken. I mean, the agreement in Moscow between Russia and America about the limitation of nuclear weapons is a very important step. But look at the ambition. The ambition of President Obama is to get rid of nuclear weapons. He said, not in my lifetime, but that's the ultimate goal. I think that is one question. Here we have a duty as allies to help the Americans, to help the new administration to realize its goals, not by being subordinates or servants or suppletives, but by consolidating the determination of America to act. America is an indispensable player, especially in the Middle East, and we have to be complementary, not competitors. And the second question, therefore, is, are we up to the challenge? It's really at a time when Europe is going through maybe another transformation, is one of the real questions to be asked. It is clear also that there is a shift. The ground is shifted in the region with Iran. The elections in Lebanon have produced something very interesting. The attitude even of Hezbollah has changed. But these ground shifts, these earthquakes, these little or bigger earthquakes, will not necessarily lead to a positive change or to a happy ending. So an active intervention is necessary in concert with a number of players, whether the regional players in the Middle East or with China when it comes to Korea and so on. So what I would like to say then, if one agrees, I hope I agree with myself at least, that this is the assessment, what are the axioms for policy? I cannot help but quoting my friend Aaron Miller in his book, where he says that the first axiom should be first do no harm. But more profoundly, I think we need to pursue resolution of issues, not continue a process. A process is an excuse to maintain the status quo. The second thing is that we need to inject a sense of urgency. There are ticking clocks in the region. Iran is one of the obvious ones. But there's also the biological clock of some leaders that should get our attention in this particular region. There's also the issue that societies in the regions have to face in terms of social development, of sustainable development, of economic development. And it's not a small task where in some places half of the population is under 20. So the third action should be that the right approach, a successful approach, should be parallel, not one thing at a time or a sequence. A lot of discussions now about first this or instead of that, this will solve the other problem, etc. I don't think it's true. To be parallel, comprehensive, and inclusive. That is also part of the message of President Obama wherever he went, in Europe, in Prague, in Cairo, to say, I'm going to do things to change for the better, but I want your contributions. So I remember when he was in Prague, I mean, he was talking, there was a lot of talk about Afghanistan. He said to European allies, thank you for your support, I need more troops. And we need more European troops. So I think this is another axiom, is that all should contribute. That is the message that the Obama administration is passing now to Arab countries, to say, okay, I've heard you. Israeli settlements are a psychological and objective obstacle to peace. But now you have to do something too. You have to promise to me that if Israel does what we're trying them to do, you're going to do something, and something not that not be words, but concrete steps toward normalization with Israel in order to give Israel the confidence that in advancing in a political process, normalization is for real, not just in a declaration. The fourth axiom to me is that the Israeli-Arab conflict is central. Whoever says the contrary doesn't read the map of as ulterior motives. It is central because you won't be solving the issue of Iran as a strategic challenge if you don't solve that before. Those who say there's an objective alliance and a secret alliance between Arab countries and Israel to forget the peace process and to go towards Iran are delusional or just not knowing the reality. It is not the case. How will you avoid the enormous economic catastrophe that could be a conflict with Iran for the region, but for us too, if you don't have an assurance that all the Arab countries, especially the oil-producing countries, will be able to make up the difference or to help us to get the energy supply continuing to flow. Therefore, the Arab Peace Initiative is a central piece of a basis for enacting or enabling a normalization with Arab countries, between Israeli and Arab countries, and creating the atmosphere for peace. There are two countries who have rejected the Arab Peace Initiative. Iran, by its own rhetoric about the destruction of Israel, and the second is Israel. So I think the efforts that are now being put in motion to create a dynamic, not a binary situation where the Arab Peace Initiative is, we offer you, if you do all this, at the end of the process, but a sort of progressive step-by-step approach is very important. The fifth axiom, I would say, is we need not only to look at the short term, the medium term, but also at the long term. We need to think now already to design the long-term future. The long-term future of this region, which is not simply agreeing on borders, agreeing on sharing waters. It's about what is the future of this region when there will be peace, when there will be, in theory, open borders, when there will be a situation where people can hope for a real better future. And I come back to the future of my friend here. When the borders are open, you can drive from Jerusalem to Beirut in what? 3 hours? 4 hours? If the roads are good? Now it takes 48 hours if you want to go from Jerusalem to Beirut. Because you have to drive to Amman and then take a plane to Cyprus and from Cyprus to Lebanon. So this is, I think, important, not only because you need to plan ahead. It's what Europeans succeeded after World War II to do. But it's also to give a picture to the people that this sort of opposition, this sort of prejudice they locked in for so long that prevents them to think big, to create this. And I think that's an area where Europe has an experience, an historical experience to show to the rest of the world. Not to impose it, it's to say that has happened and it's possible. I think since now there is a demand to have the G20 instead of the G8, where the Arab countries, the Middle East, has received its place, now it's time to show if they're ready to actively participate in the reordering of the regional order and of the larger world order. They have the means, they have the capacity, they have the human resources, But this is an area, a moment where there's no place for bystanders and cheerleaders. It's about doing the hard work, and I think the instruments that are now being designed in the framework of the G20, by the IMF, the World Bank, etc., should be things that should be also applied to the post-conflict situation in the Middle East. It's very clear, but it's not, again, a model that comes from outside. It's a model that the people of the region design together. And I think, finally, in view of the sense of urgency, in view of the complexity of the problem, by the way, if somebody wants to be the mediator, managing the complexity will be the hardest part of his job, is that the solution of this problem is of the interest not only of the locals, it's the interest of the international community. Therefore, they have no choice to simply decide when they want to solve it. If we articulate clearly that this is an international interest, it is very important that at the end there will be, given a calendar, some form of imposition. It's the only way it will work. So the critical path, if you want to get there, admitting that in parallel confidence-building measures are being taken, and that's exactly what Senator Mitchell is trying to do now, is to create an atmosphere where both parties believe that the other is sincere, is to enter a successful political action, not a process, but a political process that gets into operationalizing what we know is the parameters of a solution. So going into some sort of a sophistication of the parameters, whether you call that the Clinton parameters or the Taba parameters or something like that. If the goal is to create a Palestinian state in the two-state solution, as Israel already exists, a state is a physical space over which a legitimate government has control over the people, the natural resources, and so on. I think it's important that Palestinians build their institutions, but somebody has to say that they will not have a space in theory, they have has a state for real. And the state for real is something that is somewhere within borders. I think the main thing would be to start defining the border. If you define the border, you make things rather easier about settlements because you know what is east of the border and west of the border. And you give citizens a choice or an indication. And it's clear that everybody and all the UN resolutions, Quartet, President Bush, European declarations, the Arab Peace Initiative, all have clearly indicated it's on the basis of the 67 armistice line or green light one with 100% of the territory, 100% of the 20% of historic Palestine will be the Palestinian state, with some exchange of territories agreed by the parties. That has always also been accepted. That's why, if those don't understand why Senator Mitchell and the U.S. is now insisting on finding an agreement on settlements with Israel, it's precisely because of that. We need to define the space where the Palestinian state will be. And as long as settlements continue to grow, this is a sort of a red line for any negotiator on the other side. Where will my space be? And I think it's very important. Hopefully, Israel and the U.S. are nearing an agreement on that. Then the other issues need to be treated in the wake of that. You have created the borders, you have identified a state. This state can be then recognized by the international community or by the U.N. The other issues who need more international legitimacy, like refugees, like the status of Jerusalem, will of course have to be treated with the participation and the legitimation of these players. You cannot, no Palestinian leader can make a deal on Jerusalem without the assent of the Arabs and the Muslims. And I would say probably the Christians. Any form of international gathering, of conference that put all these people together to create this legitimacy is probably something that in the some form of future could arrive. As I said, there needs to be a calendar. It cannot be open-ended if you want to come to a resolution. And if there needs to be a mediator, not just a facilitator or somebody who tries to do crisis management. And the role of the mediator is to shepherd the parties into within the parameters of a negotiation and then say, at the end of the day, if you don't come to an agreement, I'll put one on the table. That has been done before. It has been done in other areas. That has been tried before, failed, but I think there's no going out of that. Finally, it's very important that everybody, as I said, everybody contributes. Therefore, the international community should be ready to offer contributions to this final settlement. And I'm thinking not only between Israel and the Palestinians, but also between Israel and Syria, between Israel and Lebanon. These contributions will be hugely important, whether it's for refugees, whether it's for security, whether it's for water, economic development, etc. So, are the Europeans their active party to that? I think they have been. The question is about, is there a European view? That's often the question that I've been asked. Well, there is some sort of a European view about the centrality of the problem, the importance of solving it, the awareness of common interest, the awareness of the risk for Europe if things go bad, because for us it's a neighborhood issue, and the day that Turkey is part of the EU, which I personally think should be a good thing, well, we will have a border with Iraq and with Syria, so we cannot ignore it, and it will not go away. So the reflection about the European role is a lot of a reflection about ourselves, and about what do we decide to go on, which path do we decide to go on. Is the Lisbon Treaty approved? Does that mean that we're really going to the next step or an accelerated integration? The question is still open, and you've seen the debate about the new European Commission and the difficulties that the European Parliament has found in approving the new president of the Commission. There is a lot of debate. There is a lot of questions that have been raised because of the economic crisis about the extent of solidarity. I think Europeans have to look first if they can get their act together among themselves before they try to act outside. And I think this is the first step. But if there is this determination, I think there is a body of doctrine. The idea of a Palestinian state came first out of EU declarations. There is the Venice Declaration, the Berlin Declaration in Seville. All that was articulated in a very interesting way. I find personally, as a European citizen with much more clarity at the time than we do our statements these days, but that's just, don't quote me about that. There is a strong economic presence. There is a strong trade links with the region, and this has been used as a diplomatic action. The High Representative, one of the first things that the High Representative Solana did was to participate in something that was called the Mitchell Commission. And actually, the Mitchell Report is as much a European report as it is an American report. Finally, there is more presence on the ground with military operations. I mean, UNIFIL is not a classic ESDP operation. But it's still the backbone of this force is European, it's a European command. I think it has shown the willingness of European countries to jump in. It's not a theoretical thing here. It's not an institution. It's about real people, troops from our countries, some of which have suffered casualties. I remind you that also there is a presence in the area, a military presence in the area that's mostly European, on the Golan, for instance. It's mostly European troops. There's an important capacity-building effort that is being made now with the Palestinian police, training the Palestinian police. I think personally that the European role would be extremely important, and I don't dismiss what I've just said, but would be extremely important when it comes to the after conflict and the after conflict. It's very important. After conflict, I mean by that security arrangements in the framework of a peace agreement. I think about economic incentives, but I think also about creating a vision of what would the Middle East look if all the conflicts were solved. What sort of area of prosperity could it become? Is it possible that this region is not becoming a black hole in the globalized world? So I think this is an area where not only do we have the technology, but we have the historical experience. And I think institutionalization of relations between the countries of the region is very important. These institutions that exist now don't work, don't create the sort of stability that European institutions have created after the Cold War, for instance, in Europe. And when people say, well, this is sort of a bureaucrat's dream, or is it something so far away people don't think about it, well, I remember 75, when the CSCE was started, a lot of people were saying the same thing. But the experience showed that even during the Cold War, European countries and the Soviet Union could talk to each other and with the US, and has been created there a culture of talking before shooting, the obligation to sit down, even in endless and useless discussions. But at the same time, something was built. And what we discovered after the end of the Cold War, with the Czechs, with the Poles, with the Hungarians, is that it told us the CSCE was enormously important for us. If we had not had that, especially the human rights basket, we could have not have the social transformation that we had. So this also demands a bit of an honest assessment, a critical assessment of our regional instruments. We've been selling the Barcelona process for a marvelous thing. Now the Union for the Mediterranean is another marvelous thing. I mean, the associations agreement, the neighborhood policy, all that are, in my view, very well conceived in their intentions and in their ambitions. But I think it's important if we want to be active, proactive, and not just, you know, issuing communique supporting somebody else, we need to look at that in a much more serious manner, and that is, for me, the task of the EU at the present time. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Otto.
We have about 20 minutes for questions and answers and comments, and I'd like to start with Ode briefly, who has a few comments, and then we'll turn to
actually I would like to let the audience know about the Palestinian perspective toward the European Union and how we see the European Union and what, in which way we differentiate the European Union role in the peace and conflict resolution efforts in Palestine. I see the European Union as, when I visit any hospital, I'll see the European Union donation for some relief projects, for some relief efforts. And whenever you go in or when you go through the Palestinian roads, streets, you will find signs, a lot of signs for the European Union. I totally agree that The European Union role is after the peace agreement or after the peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinian part. I do believe that the first agreement came from the European nations, and I do believe that the Americans should collaborate positively with the European nation to pressure more the Israelis and Palestinian leaders for more and deep negotiation and serious negotiation at this time, because there is a huge effort paid by the European Union taxpayer, the residents, the employees here in the European countries for infrastructure building and building or establishing to build the Palestinian country or the future Palestinian country. So I'm wondering to ask Mr. Oat how to protect the taxpayer money in Palestine, and in which manners can we save their donation for the future Palestinian state?
Brief answer, Mr. Oat, and then I'll...
Okay, I can take a very brief answer by concluding peace as soon as possible. In a more nuanced fashion, we could do things now that would save taxpayers' money. The need to pay the salaries of the Palestinian Authority and to invest their money in more productive investment, but for that you need to relaunch the economy. And that is something where Israel has an important play. I don't want to enter into all the discussion, but you know what the World Bank has said about access and movement, and I think this is what it is. I don't think European taxpayers are unhappy about helping the Palestinians, but you're right to ask the question. It's also a question of dignity for the Palestinians. They don't want to live under a subsidized economy forever. So my answer is big peace.
And I just wanted to add to what Ode said. Of course, it wasn't just the European Union nations that were involved in the first peace process. It's called the Oslo process for a reason. I want to say that because we have someone from the Norwegian embassy sitting here. So let's not forget Norway and all of this.
Norway is almost part of the EU. They took the best and rejected the last. So they're very clever.
Okay, we have questions. Do we have the microphones? Let's start with the front row. And then we'll work our way backwards. Gentlemen here. We'll collect a few questions, and then we'll allow Mr. Ott to answer them collectively. Please introduce yourself.
Khaled Nadim, South Asian Middle East Forum. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Ott, for your presentation. What I would like to know is, you've been in this role for 6 years. What do you think you've actually achieved in your own right in the peace process between the Israelis and Palestinians? What role have you played? Because many people would say that you're just running after the Americans, and the Americans are going to come. People like George Mitchell are going to come, and they're the ones who are going to say to the Israelis and Palestinians, "You've got to do it." Well, if you go there, they're just going to sit there and not really take much reaction. So, I mean, you've been in 6 years in this post. It's a very difficult. I can imagine it's a very difficult post to hold, because basically you're going backwards and forwards. But how would you say are the high points of your in dealing with the Palestinians and Israelis and bringing them together yourself?
Could you just hand it to your neighbour?
Thank you, Claire Spence of Chatham House. I want to, from that, broaden out the discussion. So I was very interested in what you said about President Lula's comments, and I shall be looking for Le Monde later on. But I'm wondering, given this changing strategic context, and the fact that, as you rightly say, some of the existing approaches have been very stale, there is a tendency, I mean, my eyes went skyward when you mentioned the Union for the Mediterranean, because it is precisely blocked in its implementation because of the continuing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I know contacts are being renewed. But it's also notable that other things are happening around the region. For example, you're probably aware in, I think it was February, March this year, of the big Latin American Arab summit that took place in Qatar, and none of the usual suspects, no G8 nations, no Europeans, no US, nobody was there. This was a bilateral region-to-region initiative. So I suppose my question is there any room now, given that the role of the Russians within the BRICS has not been terribly prominent on the quartet, but for, say, the Brazilians or others to contribute in some sort of way to the actual implementation, to changing the atmosphere and getting away from the rather stereotypical assignation of roles, you know, the banker, the payer to the EU, and the, you know, everybody relying on the US to produce the political results. So is there any prospect in changing that?
Claire, could you, yes, to your, to the person behind you. Thank you.
Alam Akram, journalist and peace and human rights campaigner. I am a great believer that no matter what, we still need to support Obama's vision. With, but again, I would like to frame it, as he mentioned, in the 2 years, 2 years vision. But still, and the only way I would think of that is by supporting certain steps which the United States must take immediately after, particularly after after Netanyahu's horrible speech to the Arab world and to the Muslim world. I think that the only way to improve the situation, and by the support of EU as well as Jewish people around the world, particularly J State Lobby Group, I think that we need a clear and a clear commitment from Israel, which should be supported, you know, by the United States, improve the human rights situation in the occupied territory, particularly that will improve at least Israel image, as well as it will create an atmosphere of credibility for the world, not to Obama and the world. The crossing, the Gaza crossing, that should be reopened at least for humanitarian stuff. The check blocks, which is over 600, at least reduce them to 40 or something. Whatever it is, what the measures I am talking about do not cost the taxpayers any money, and it is urgent to create some hope and some positive atmosphere. Particularly, there are 2 points: prisoners, which are over 10,000, and the dressing prisoners in red overhauls similar to Guantanamo. That is a very humiliating and insult to the Arab world. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rod, would you like to respond to some of these questions and comments? What have you accomplished last 6 years?
If you're asking me, there were days where I was getting off the plane and wanted to go hand over my phone and dossier and do something else. Yes, there have been days. I think there are people who have been there much longer than me and have felt the same. Now, you must understand the nature of the function. You have a certain mandate that is couched in very general terms. I've always tried, I mean, what I think, if to answer more directly, I think I've participated in growing European consensus about things to do. I cannot decide in the place of government and actually do it. That is certainly a thing. We have been successful in putting in place something, things that work. The first thing that worked was the monitoring, one of the first things that worked was the monitoring mission in Rafah. It worked. It worked very well. I negotiated the agreement, and at that time there was full consensus between Israelis and Palestinians. They were around the table. We brokered the agreement. We were able to deploy that mission in less than 20 days. Even the Americans were rather impressed. There was a very strong will of the Americans to do that. And it worked. And I can tell you the day that it started unraveling. And that is the day that Gilad Shalit was attacked. That is the only why Israel started then to fiddle with the agreement and to eventually collapse. It is a question, the Rafah agreement fell on the Hamas-Israel confrontation. The capacity building that we've done with the Palestinian police, in my view, is a success. success because it has been reversing the logic of creating, black and tan militia, if you want, to use an analogy that's comprehensible here, but a real police, community police, people that were primarily preoccupied with the security of the Palestinians. I think this has been understood eventually, both by Israel, and I must be honest and objective, we've been helped by the Israeli, especially the Israeli Defense Ministry about that. It has created another atmosphere. It has allowed the Palestinian government of Salam Fayyad to start to show what kind of governance could happen in this region. The parallel work that we've been doing with the finance ministry, it's something that is a great success. I would like to see any of the neighboring country showing the sort of financial accountability that the Palestinian Authority has been able to do under occupation. So I think this is, of course, a homage to the Palestinians more than to us, but we've been instrumental in that. I am positive, you don't need to believe me, that I'm not running after the Americans, or if I'm running after the Americans, is to tell them what not to do in certain circumstances, and I think it has an impact. But I am realistic enough to know that it's much more difficult to maneuver 27 governments plus a commission that also thinks that they have a foreign policy of their own. Don't quote me about that either. Than to manage, you know, the chain of command that is the U.S. government. So the nature of diplomatic action by an EU representative is naturally different than the nature of the diplomatic action that of a foreign minister or the French foreign minister or things like that. So have we achieved peace? No, obviously not. It's a would lie. Have we achieved some improvements? Definitely we have. And it would not have been possible if I was not running around, not abroad, outside Europe, but in the region itself, among people, building confidence, working together. Has that made a difference? It has made a difference. It has not solved the conflict. I fully agree with you. That's why I'm saying when there's no contradiction, for instance, in supporting now the new U.S. administration. And I would say that modestly, for once, the Americans have aligned themselves on the European positions. So it's not a bad thing. So Europe is about the long term, the long haul, the patience. We have learned that. And I remember when I started my job, one of the first personalities that I met was President Mubarak. He says, let me give you one advice. You need a lot of patience. So I followed his advice. I've shown patience. I must say I owe the modest success that we have had of the quality of the contributions that member states made to my team. I have a team of fantastic European diplomats, of the policemen that have been delegated. So it's a collective effort that has shown that if we want to act together, we can. As we know, the problems of the world are a bit more complicated than for the Europeans alone to solve.
I guess that goes back to what O'Day said before, in the sense that maybe to us, a lot of the EU contribution is not very visible, but if you're in Palestine, it very much is. And it is probably difficult to imagine how much worse the situation would be if all that wasn't happening.
Well, you cannot prove the negative, but I believe that, and that's why I think, you know, in terms of work sharing, that's what I said at the end. I mean, we have things that the Americans don't have, and the Americans have things that we don't have, and it's a spirit of complementarity. There's no subordination. I think in the quartet, the EU and the US have been the driving forces and have been coming to understanding. I think the last 8 years would have been much worse without the Europeans. So, you don't see what you avoid. But I think that has been the case. It's mixed results, but who has achieved 100% results in that region in particular?
Can I, because I, sure. I'm conscious we will not be able to answer all the questions, but let me just give the opportunity two more people to get in with a question. Yes, and please introduce yourself.
I will.
And
then I will.
Yes. I guess the microphone doesn't work,
yes,
so we'll just give up on that. Gavin, you have to speak up.
Okay,
and introduce yourself. Mr. Ott, you have 3 minutes to answer all these questions.
Fine.
And
go back to the questions that I had not time to address. On other people participating, yes, obviously, everybody's asked to participate. But I would say there's been a lack of interest asked. But it is potentially there. Brazil was invited to Annapolis, for instance, so it is clear that no limit. And as we are working to continue state and institution building, I just received a letter from the foreign minister of Turkey indicating that they wanted to contribute to our police mission. I think. And I don't forget the other Europeans. Norway was mentioned, but Switzerland has been a very active contributor also and working with us. So I think, yes, there is a place for that. When it comes to what happens in the Palestinian territories, and the speech of Netanyahu, for instance, I would go back to the suggestions of my friend Hami Kouri, except instead of saying that the speech is bad, there should be an answer from the Arabs. And he said, we the Arabs should outline a vision, an alternative vision, instead of saying, Netanyahu says it's bullshit or trash. And when it comes to human rights in the Palestinian territories, yes, it's part of that. Again, a shortcut is to say, conclude peace. There would be no more other government to blame for human rights than in Palestine than the Palestinian government. The answer to the human rights situation is to end the occupation. I think it's very clear. When it comes to Arab refugees, Jewish refugees, well, the end of conflict means an end of all claims. Everybody agrees to that. So that is part of the negotiation. I don't know how the partners will solve it, but it's clearly what is being pursued right now. The end of all claims. And that is a wish by the Israeli government, much more than by as much as by the others. And that's what the quartet said in his last statement, to say that a final settlement means the end of all claims, including refugees. When it comes to the question about governance gaps and European instruments, well, yes, I said that. I think if you want to be relevant, you need to, and it's about aid. I've always said to European governments, to the European Commission, stop saying that you're the biggest donor to this or that, the Palestinians or any other party. They try to say that you're the most efficient one. And by the way, the biggest donor to the Palestinian Authority is the United States of America. For those who are. So I think it is very clear that We have a particular technology, because of our own history, as I said, to create multilateral processes that produce more than the sum of its parts. But we need to be efficient. Now, the governance issue is a touchy one, and it is something that is always the complicated one when it comes to discussing with some of the regimes in the region. But the fact that there is a pressure for reform has produced some results. The fact that we have put, you know, there was a lot of discussion about the upgrade of relations with Israel. What people generally ignore is that the first country to get that sort of upgrade was Morocco. And Morocco did a lot of things to reform its internal system and so on. Why? Because there was that aspiration. And I know Morocco is a special case because they would prefer to be on the other side of the Mediterranean, but nevertheless, they have done that. Jordan is doing the same, is in the process of doing the same. So I think, yes, it has an impact. But Europe is not about sending troops to topple governments. It's about generational transformation. But I think that doesn't excuse us for not looking at our instruments to make sure that money, human resources are used properly, especially in this time of economic crisis where governments have more limited resources. So I think it is a duty to articulate the vision of what could this region be should people decide to put their conflict behind them. But in order to be credible, you need to have the credible instruments to do that. That was the basis of my reasoning. And it was not implying criticism of what Europe is doing, simply having the experience in the field and responding again to the gentleman who asked what I have accomplished is to, one of the things that I've accomplished is that I have a better idea of how to work better.
No need to be defensive.
No, I'm not defensive. I'm not defensive, but I think this is a sort of thing that you don't see. But it's really there, and all the people who have been working in the field for so long have an experience. So the jury is still out, but I think since there is a perspective, now is the moment. Because if you offer that perspective now, you contribute a lot to the actual negotiations. That was exactly why the Israeli government 2 years ago asked the European Union to upgrade relations with the EU, because it was an instrument for them to sell political concessions to the Palestinians. So this is generally how I see things and how we have, by using these instruments, really contribute.
First of all, let me apologize because being German, I get very, very nervous when we're running a minute or two over time. So I'm very sorry I have to cut you off here. Ms. Sauter, but thank you very much.
Visit the region more often.
for an incredibly interesting, frank and honest overview of the EU's role, and thank you also, Dave, for contributing to that. We're breaking for lunch now. Lunch is upstairs, and if you think you haven't had enough Israelis so far, there are going to be 5 at once in an hour's time. So please do come back at 1:45 when we will continue. Thank you very much.